You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, that are the sole translators of Steiner into English and have given me permission to record these works. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of a set of cycles by Rudolf Steiner, Collected Works, Volume 181, entitled Dying Earth and Living Cosmos is the first one. The second is The Living Gifts of Anthroposophy. And the third is The Need for New Forms of Consciousness, translated by Matthew Barton, 21 lectures. This is Lecture 3, given in Berlin on the 5th of February, 1918. In considering the totality of phenomena in the world, and to stand in the world in the most ideally practical way, it is important, as we have often discussed from many different angles, to consider the deeper human importance, one greater than external observation accords it, of the alternation between waking and sleeping. Ordinary inquiry finds only that our awareness apparently fluctuates between states of sleeping and waking. We know this is only a seeming truth. From many different perspectives, we have often discussed how the state of what we call sleep does not only last from the moment we fall asleep to when we awaken again, but that it also continues in a particular aspect of our being while we are awake. It has to be said that we are never fully awake in our whole being. Sleep, therefore, extends into our waking state. In one part of our nature, we are continually asleep. And now we can ask what part of our nature is really fully, continually wakeful, while we are, as it were, called awake. We are always awake in relation to our sensory perceptions, all that we perceive of the sensory world through our senses while awake, the characteristic quality of ordinary sensory perception, is that on awakening we swiftly enter into close connection with the external sensory world. Our senses are quickly activated. And this pulls us out of the dull state we ordinarily know as that of sleep. Thus we are truly awake in our sensory perceptions. We are less wakefully alert in our thinking, and careful self-observation can show this. You can find more details about it in my book titled Riddles of the Soul. And yet this state can also still be called a waking one. We should distinguish between our sensory perceptions and our actual thinking. When we reflect or contemplate without reference to sensory perception, and thus without turning to the outer world, we are awake both in the ordinary and in a higher sense, although this kind of waking in our life of thought is tinged with a dreamy quality, more in some people and less in others. While a dreamy quality can mingle with the thinking of many people, by and large we can say that we are awake when we think. But we are not awake in feeling. Of course, feelings surge up in us from an indeterminate, undifferentiated life of soul. And by picturing our feelings, so that wakeful activity in the form of thinking mingles with this feeling, we believe we are awake in our feelings too. In reality, our soul sensibility, in feeling, is exactly the same as in ordinary dreaming. There is a deep affinity between the state of dreaming and the condition in which we feel things. If we were always able to illumine our dreams with thinking, whereas in fact we are oblivious of most of our dream experiences, in the same way as we do this with our feeling life, we would be aware of our dreaming to precisely the same degree as we are of our feelings. You see, feelings are actually present in the soul in just the same way as dreams. Feelings, emotions, and even in a sense passions and desires live in our soul like dreams. No one is capable of commenting in full waking alertness on what is really occurring in him when he feels. As I have said, this surges up out of an indeterminate, undifferentiated life of soul, and is then illumined by the light of thinking, but it is a life of dreaming. This affinity between emotions, feelings, and dreams is something observers have recognized without recourse to esoteric inquiry. For instance, the excellent art philosopher Friedrich Theodor Fischer has often emphasized the deep affinity between feeling and dreaming in the human psyche. Will activity lies still deeper in our life of soul. How conscious are we of what happens within us when, say, we decide to pick up a book, and when our arm reaches out and does so? We are no more aware of what occurs in the interaction of muscles and nerves in our organism, and what also occurs in our soul when an impulse of will passes into movement and action, than of what happens in us in deep dreamless sleep. Once again, our life of thinking casts light on the nature of our will life in a way that makes it seem we know what is happening. But in fact, the real nature of this will life remains immersed in the deepest sleep while we are awake. We are therefore really awake in the true sense in relation to our sensory perception and our life of thinking. We are asleep in relation to our feeling life, even when we're awake, and profoundly asleep in relation to our life of will. Thus the state of sleep extends into our waking life. So, let us picture how we walk through the world. What we experience wakefully in our awareness is really only our perception of the sensory world and our world of thoughts, and embedded in this experience is a world in which our feelings and will impulses float, a world surrounding us as the air does, but which ordinary awareness does not enter at all. Whoever sees human experience in this way is really not very far removed from acknowledging the existence of what we may call a supersensible world around him. All I have described, however, has more significant outcomes. Underlying it are important realities affecting all of life. In acquainting ourselves with the life of the human soul between death and rebirth, and you can do so more theoretically by reading the lectures I gave in Vienna in the spring of 1914, we discover that we are living with the so-called dead in this world we traverse when asleep. The dead are always there. They move and live in a supersensible world. We are not separated from them by our reality, but only by our state of awareness. We are only separated from the dead in the same way that we are separated in sleep from the things around us. Asleep in a room, we do not see chairs or other objects, despite the fact that they are there. In our so-called waking state, asleep in our feeling and will, we are amongst the so-called dead, though we do not recognize it, in the same way that we fail to perceive physical objects around us in our bedroom when we are asleep. We therefore do not live apart from the world in which the powers of the dead hold sway, but are with them in a shared and common world. Only our state of awareness, of consciousness, separates us from them. This knowledge that we live in community with the dead will be one of the most important insights spiritual science can implant in general human awareness in future. Those who believe that all that happens around them occurs only by virtue of the powers active in sensory existence know nothing about reality. They do not know that the powers of the dead continually play into this existence of ours and are continually present here. And if you remember what I said in Lecture 1 about the false view of history that prevails today in the age of materialism, and that the real impulses at work in history unfold as if in dream or sleep, you will be able to understand that the powers of the dead can live too, in the historical realities we dream or sleep through. In future, our view of history will include and take account of the powers of those who who have crossed the threshold of death, whose souls live in a world that exists between death and rebirth. An awareness of the whole of humanity, including the so-called dead, will be able to give culture an entirely new aspect. The mode of inquiry employed by a spiritual researcher, who can put what has been said here to practical use, reveals many specific details of the shared life of the so-called living and the so-called dead. If one were able to shine the light of thinking down into one's feelings and impulses of will, it would be possible to have ongoing, vivid awareness of the life of the dead. We cannot do this in ordinary awareness, and this is because things are strangely separated in our conscious life. We can say that for comprehending higher cosmic realities, a third thing is actually far more important than an awareness of our states of waking and sleep. What is this third element? The third thing, lying between those two states, is for modern humankind a mere fleeting moment easily overlooked, the moment of falling asleep and the moment of awakening. Nowadays, people do not pay much attention to this, and yet these intermediate states are extremely important in our overall consciousness. We can discover how important by illumining ordinary unconscious experiences with clairvoyant awareness. For many years now, we have been preparing the ground for this, and can now therefore confidently illumine such things by insight into supersensible realities. While not as straightforward an approach as what has just been described, it is certainly possible for clairvoyant awareness to acquaint itself not only in general terms with supersensible realities in the world we dwell within, between death and rebirth, but specifically, if you will forgive this rough and ready way of putting it, to enter into contact or correspondence with an individual disembodied soul. You are aware of this, of course. I will only add that this form of inquiry is difficult for a general scientific comprehension of supersensible conditions, only because there are many more obstacles to be overcome in the process. Although so few people nowadays succeed in eliciting generalized scientific findings about the supersensible world, we cannot say that this is particularly difficult, since it is not so very far removed from people's ordinary soul capacities. It is more difficult to make contact with these souls individually, simply because a real, specific, individual connection between a human soul living here in a body and a disembodied soul requires the person seeking such contact to be able to really live to a sufficient degree in a purely spiritual realm, undisturbed by the fact that this tangible life in pure spirit very easily awakens a person's lower urges. I have often stated why this is so. The higher capacities of supersensible beings have an affinity with lower human urges rather than with the higher promptings of embodied human beings. And in the same way, the lower urges of supersensible beings have an affinity with higher spiritual human qualities. This is an important secret of communication with the supersensible world, one that can very easily thwart a person's efforts. But once this obstacle has been overcome, we can have supersensible communication without being diverted or led astray from a world of spiritual experiences. Yet this communication takes a very different form from anything we are used to considering as such here in the sensory world. I'll describe this very specifically. In the sensory world, you speak to another person, and the other replies. You are aware that you are creating the words you speak with your voice, and that these words originate in your thoughts. You feel that you are the creator of your words. While you are speaking, you hear yourself and then hear the other when he replies. And you know that, as the other speaks, you are listening. You are fallen silent. Excuse me, you have fallen silent. We become very accustomed to this form of interpersonal communication, to awareness of it. Communication with disembodied souls is different. However strange it sounds, it is the very opposite. When you yourself communicate your thoughts to a disembodied soul, it is not you who speaks, but the other. It is just as if you were speaking with another person, and he, not you, expressed what you were thinking and wished to communicate. And what a so-called dead soul replies to you does not come toward you from without, either, but rises from within you. You experience it as your inner life. Clairvoyant consciousness first has to accustom itself to this, to being a questioner within the other, and to receiving his reply within oneself. This complete inversion of one's being is necessary, but is far from easy, for it contradicts everything we are ordinarily accustomed to, habits formed over our lifetime. It even contradicts our inherent nature. It is intrinsic in our nature to think that when we ask something, we ourselves speak and the other listens. And yet the reverse of this is true in our communication with supersensible beings. This inversion undergone by clairvoyant consciousness will show you that people's lack of perception of the dead is very largely due to the entirely unaccustomed and seemingly impossible way the latter communicate with the living. If we return now to those transitional fleeting moments between waking and sleeping, we find that invariably one such state is suitable for asking and the other for replying. As we fall asleep, this is an especially opportune moment for asking questions of the dead, or in other words, for hearing from the dead the questions we ask them. In falling asleep, we are in a condition well fitted for hearing from the dead what it is we wish to ask them. Since we fall asleep immediately afterward, this means we ask literally hundreds of questions of the dead, speak hundreds of things to them as we fall asleep, but know nothing about this since we have fallen asleep afterward. This fleeting moment of falling asleep is of huge importance for our communication with the dead. The moment of awakening, on the other hand, is especially opportune for hearing the replies of the dead within us. If we did not pass immediately into sense perception when we woke up, but tarried in the moment of awakening, we would be well fitted at that moment to receive messages from the dead. But these messages would appear to rise up from within us. You see, there are two reasons why ordinary awareness fails to hearken to communications with the dead. One is that the moments of transition are followed by awakening on the one hand and falling asleep on the other, both states extinguishing what we experience in these transitional moments. The other is that the form of communication involved is one we find unaccustomed or impossible. As we fall asleep, the hundreds of questions we could and do ask the dead are submerged in sleep itself, because we are so unaccustomed to hear rather than speak what we are asking. And what the dead say to us as we awaken is something that does not seem to come from the dead themselves, since it rises within us, and so we regard it as our own. These general phenomena are sometimes, however, transformed in the following way. What we experience as our questioning of the dead, which comes toward us from them, seems to continue through sleep. As we continue to sleep, we look back unconsciously to the moment we fell asleep, so that dreams arise in consequence. Such dreams can in fact be embodiments of the questions we ask the dead. And it is true that we approach much closer to the dead in these dreams than we realize, and speak to them, although what we experience in such a dream was spoken already, immediately before we fell asleep. The dream draws it forth from the soul's undifferentiated depths. But we easily misinterpret it. When we recall these dreams, we do not usually understand what they signify. Dreams are really always a communal life with the dead proceeding from our feeling life. We incline toward the dead, and a dream often presents us with the questions we ask them. It embodies our subjective experience, but as if this came to us from outside. The dead soul speaks to us, but really we ourselves are speaking, and it only appears as if the dead person were speaking to us. What we encounter in such dreams, as a rule, are not messages from the dead, but an expression of our need to be in communication with them, and the fact that we succeed in meeting them for a moment as we fell asleep. The moment of awakening does bring us messages from the dead. This moment is extinguished by the life of the senses that follows immediately. But it can also happen as we wake up, if we practice very careful self-observation, that we discern something we know does not come from our ordinary eye, capital. And messages from the dead often come to us like that. You will only properly understand these ideas if you pay due regard to time relationships in the supersensible world. The moment of falling asleep is well suited for asking questions of the dead, and the moment of awakening for receiving their replies. These two moments are therefore distinct from each other. As Richard Wagner so aptly expressed, with remarkable intuition, quote, there time becomes space, close quote. In the supersensible world, time really does become space, in the same way that one point of space is here and another there. In other words, time is not past, but a point in space is just at a lesser or greater distance. Supersensibly, time becomes space, and the dead soul gives a reply only by standing further away from us. Again, we are very unaccustomed to such a thought. In the supersensible world, the past is not past. It exists, is still present. And the present moment means only that we stand at a different point in relation to what occurred previously. The past is as little past in the world of spirit as the house has vanished that you left earlier this evening to come to this lecture. It remains in its place, and likewise the past remains in the supersensible world. It goes on being there. And whether you are standing close to the dead soul or further away from him depends on you, on how far you have traveled with him. It may be a very great distance or very close. You see, as well as being asleep or awake, we also, of course, fall asleep and wake up. And because of this, we are in continual contact and correspondence with the dead. They are always amongst us. And so we are by no means only influenced by the physical human beings around us, but also by those who have crossed death's threshold and are connected with us. Today I want to emphasize realities which, from a certain perspective, can lead us ever deeper into the supersensible world. Now, having understood that there is continual contact with the dead, we can distinguish between different souls who have crossed over into death. Passing continually through the realm of the dead ourselves, either by posing questions as we fall asleep, or receiving answers from them when we wake up, our connection with the souls of the dead will be different, depending on whether they died young or in old age. The realities are at work here are only apparent to clairvoyant awareness. Knowledge of this is one thing, and its reality another. Each and every one of us is connected with the dead, as clairvoyant consciousness can teach us. But when younger people die, children or adolescents, their connection with those who are still alive is different in kind from that between the living and people who have died in the evening twilight of their years. There is a marked difference here. When we lose children, when people die in early youth, they do not really fully leave us, but stay close to us instead. Clairvoyant awareness can discern this in the fact that the messages we receive on awakening are vivid and lively if they relate to children or young people who have passed away. The connection between those still alive and those who have died is one we can describe by saying that we have not actually lost the child or adolescent. They stay here with us. And they do so, above all, because after death, they show a lively urge to work into our awakening moments, to send us messages as we wake up. It is remarkable but true that a person who has died in childhood or youth has a great deal to do with everything related to awakening. It is particularly interesting for clairvoyant consciousness to discern that those who develop a certain piety in outward life, who feel a certain inclination to pious devotion, owe this to souls who have died young. Souls who died in childhood or youth send messages that elicit this, and their influence on such piety is really very great indeed. It is different when people die in old age. Then clairvoyant consciousness shows us that they do not lose us. They remain close to our souls. Please note the subtle difference here. We do not lose the souls of those who die young. They remain among us. And those who die in old age do not lose us. We can say that they take something of our souls with them. I am speaking metaphorically. Souls who have died at an older age tend to draw us toward them, whereas those who die young draw closer to us. This is why, at the moment we fall asleep, we have much to say to souls who died when they were old, and we can forge a strong connection to the world of spirit by dwelling upon these older dead as we fall asleep. There is really quite a lot we can do in relation to these matters. We have an ongoing connection with the dead, a kind of asking and answering, an interaction and interplay with them. Our capacity to ask, and thus to approach more closely to the dead, is especially enhanced if we avoid ordinary abstract thoughts, thus ones drawn from materialistic life. If they belong to us in some way, the dead suffer too from the way we are distracted by purely material life. If, by contrast, we hold fast to what connects us in feeling and will with the dead and cultivate it, this is good preparation for posing the right questions to them and for entering into contact with them at the moment we fall asleep. The relationship we have with them primarily exists by virtue of the connection we had with them while they were alive. Our connection with them in life is the basis for our further connection with them after death. Naturally, it matters whether my connection in life involved speaking to the other with indifference or sympathy, whether I speak with them as someone I am fond of or with an indifferent air. There is a great difference between just chatting to someone randomly at tea time or showing real interest in what I may learn from him. During life, we can cultivate more intimate connections with others that engage our feelings and will impulses. Then further cultivate these after death in a feeling way, through interest in the other soul and real curiosity about any replies the soul may give. Or we may feel a prompting to remain important to the other soul and nurture our reminiscences of him, reminiscences that do not issue from our thinking, but from soul relationships. All this will fit us to approach the soul in question at the moment we fall asleep. We can best fit ourselves to receive messages at the moment we wake up, on the other hand, if we have been able and willing to engage perceptively with the person in question during his life. Just reflect how easily we pass others by, especially nowadays, without really getting to know them. What do people really know about each other today? To take a very strange but striking example of this, there are marriages that last for years on end without the husband and wife ever really getting to know each other. Yes, this happens. but it is fully possible, and this does not depend on some special talent, but just on love, really, to enter lovingly into the being of the other, and thereby to carry in oneself a real picture, a world of thoughts about the other person. And this is very good preparation for receiving replies from the dead soul at the moment of awakening. This is also really why one may be more likely to receive replies on awakening from a soul who died young, since we often more easily get to know young people than those who, growing older, have become more inward. We can therefore do something to cultivate the right relationship between the living and the dead. Our whole life, really, is permeated by this relationship. As souls, we are embedded in the sphere where the dead also dwell. The degree of piety we develop, as I said before, is very much connected with how souls who died young act upon us. And if these souls did not impinge on life, there would probably be no piety at all in us. It is therefore best for us to relate to the souls of those who have died young by keeping our remembrance of them more general. Funerals and memorial services for children or young people should always have a more general and ritual form. Some kind of ritual service should be held for the death of young people. The Catholic Church, which sets great store by youth and childhood, and really would prefer to have only children amongst its flock, to have children's souls in its care, tends to avoid holding individual addresses at children's funerals. This is actually very good. Our grief and mourning for children is of a different kind than for older people. I would call the mourning for dead children a, quote, grief of sympathy, close quote. For the grief in this case is often a mirroring in our own soul of the being of the child who remains, really, in our close proximity. We go on living the child's life with him, and his being joins in with the grief, a grief of sympathy, therefore, of shared feeling. Our mourning for older people is not of this kind, and if it is, it becomes egotistical. It is best sustained by the thought that really the person who has died at an older age takes us with him. He does not lose us as long as we try to fit ourselves to accompany him. For this reason, we can celebrate a more individualized kind of memorial service for the soul, can carry him more in our thoughts, and remain united with the thoughts about him we have cultivated, and try not to be an awkward companion for him. He takes us with him, but he possesses us in an uncomfortable way if we have thoughts that he simply cannot assimilate. We remain with him, but we can become a burden for him if he has to drag us along with him, because we fail to cultivate thoughts he can relate to, that he can spiritually discern. Consider how tangible our relationships with the dead become if we can really illumine them through spiritual science, if we are really able to view the whole connection between the living and the dead. In future, humanity will find it important to consider this. However trivial it may sound, since we could say that every era is a, quote, period of transition, close quote, our time is indeed a transitional era. It must pass into a more spiritual era. It has to become acquainted with what comes to us from the realm of the dead, and realize that we are surrounded by the dead as much as we are by the air we breathe. A time will come when people develop the real sense that they ought not to be a brick wall for someone who has died, but that they are a brick wall for him if they bear thoughts within them that the dead cannot assimilate. Imagine how rich life would become if we realize this. It will make our community with the dead a real togetherness. I have often said that the science of the spirit has no intention of establishing a new religion, nor of introducing something sectarian into the world. This would be to completely misunderstand it. On the contrary, I have often emphasized that it can deepen human religiosity by creating real foundations for it. There is a religious aspect to rites and services for the dead, to memorial services, and a basis is created for this aspect of religious life if we illumine life through spiritual science. When the right thing is done, life is raised from abstract considerations into realities. For instance, it is not a matter of indifference whether a funeral service is held for a younger or an older person. Such things, the right or wrong way to hold a funeral or memorial service, depending on whether the person who has died was younger or older, are far more important for human community than, say, a decision taken by the local council or by parliament, however odd this may seem. You see, the impulses at work in life will emerge from human individuals themselves when people have the right relationship to the world of the dead. Today, people try to organize everything through abstract social structures. They are happy if they don't have to think too much about what they are supposed to do. Things look very different, however, if we develop a living awareness, not just of a pantheistic union with a spiritual world, but of tangible community with a differentiated world of spirit. It is possible to envisage religious life becoming pervaded with specific thoughts and insights if this religiosity can be deepened through spiritual science. As I have often said, the spirit was abolished for Western mankind in the year 869 by the 8th Ecumenical Council in Constantinople. A Catholic dogma was established that the human being should no longer be seen as consisting of body, soul, and spirit, but only of body and soul, the latter being assigned certain added, quote, spiritual qualities, close quote. This abolition of the spirit is hugely significant. In Constantinople in 869, the dogma was asserted that the human being could no longer be regarded as endowed with anima and spiritus, but should be seen only as possessing unam animam rationalem et intellectualem. Forgive my Latin attempt. End of aside. The, quote, soul with spiritual qualities, close quote, is a dogma that has spread dim twilight over Western culture since the 9th century. And it is time for this to be overcome. The spirit must be acknowledged again. It was heretical in medieval times to acknowledge the doctrine of trichotomy, of body, soul, and spirit. But now it must be accorded its proper place again, its true validity for understanding human nature. It may be difficult to persuade people of this today, especially as they naturally repudiate authority and insist that the human being has only a body and a soul. This is true not just of those who confess a particular faith, but also students of philosophy and other disciplines. The philosophers, as you can read, only distinguish a body and a soul and leave out any mention of the spirit. This is what their, quote, unprejudiced, close quote, worldview amounts to. And yet it originates in nothing other than a church decree in the year 869. World-famous philosophers, such as the much-trumpeted Wilhelm Wundt, assign only a body and soul to the human being. Wundt thinks that this is his own unprejudiced scientific view, unaware of his obedience to the Ecumenical Council decision of 869. It is important to consider the facts if we wish to understand what occurs in the real world. If we consider realities such as those described today, we can come to realize how we are connected with a realm that history dreams and sleepwalks through. History, and the human life it records, can only be seen in the proper light if we can also develop a proper awareness of the connection between the so-called living and the so-called dead. When we meet again, we will speak further of these things. The end of Lecture 3.